P in 2015. And I remember, because I have to tell this story, the reason why I wanted you on the show is because we have developed sort of a rivalry between Winston-Salem State and UNC Pembroke. I mean, in basketball, in football. I mean, we've kind of been, it's a little rivalry. And every year we open up against you guys, but we won't do it this year because of COVID-19. So I'm disappointed.
I am too. And you're a competitor. You don't like to lose.
Yeah, no. I don't like to lose. And I got to share the story with our listeners, because this is a very important story. It tells you the relationship that you and I had. So in 2015, we're playing UNC Pembroke in the opening game of our football season. And, you know, I'm pretty excited about that. The game goes on. I greet you and Rebecca early on and so forth. I'm glad you're here. You decided, I called you. I said, are you coming to the game? You said, oh, yes, I'm coming to the game. We get to the game and the game starts. Now, you remember this. I know you remember this. And so, we go up 17 to nothing. We go up 17 to nothing. You come over at halftime to the chancellor's box. And you're in the chancellor's box and you're so gracious. And I mean, you know, I'm not giving you a hard time because I'm never satisfied. If I'm up by 30 points, I don't know if we're going to win the game, but we're up by 17. I'm feeling pretty good. And then you tell me, you say, well, you know, I got to go back over and I got to be with the fans and my fans are over there. I'll see you after the game. Right. And the second half, I don't know what happened in the second half. You guys come all the way back in this game and win this game. And now I want to understand how you won this game. And then you shared with me something that I'll always remember. You told me that you went back over to the other side and that you did some sort of Native American dance. You told me, you said, and you danced and all, you did some sort of rain dance. And you changed the structure of the cosmos or the atmosphere. You came back. You told me that story, man. So I've never forgotten that.
So I come up to, you know, we're up there at the game and I'm looking down at Elwood. And this is one of my first games and he's down there with his team pumping him up and running back and forth and pumping the air and so forth. And I'm saying, wow, man, this guy is pretty serious. And so, yeah, 17 to nothing. And I'm saying, wow, this is going to be embarrassing. I hope we score. I hope at least it's not a shutout. So I go back over, like you say, at halftime. And the game final score was 21 to 17. Not that anyone remembers.
Who remembers the score, right?
Elwood said, what in the world happened? That's a secret, man. Can't tell you.
I know you didn't want to tell me, but I told that story the next year, Robin, to our football team. I told them the exact same story. And I also told Denise, you know, my wife, I told Denise, had I known he was doing an American Indian dance, I said, I would have countered that. I would have put on some jazz, some rhythm and blues. I would have done something to counteract that. And so I told the team that the next year to make sure that they understood what we were up against.
I think they heard you too.
Great story. So since then, we've been very good friends. I enjoy your company. I enjoy being, Denise and I enjoy so much hanging out with you and Rebecca. And we look forward to doing that really soon going forward. Just wanted to give our audience a sense of the person who is now chancellor at UNC Pembroke. Now, you were installed in 2015, is that correct? When was your installation?
July 15, 2015, my installation was in that following fall, October time range. I don't remember the exact date.
Yeah, and so I remember the installation, and then I also remember that I was installed shortly after that. And I remember, I can remember very vividly during that time, I was walking around campus because it was doing homecoming and Founders Day at Winston-Salem State. And I think I ran into you and Zito and you were walking across campus, and it meant a lot that you guys were there for my installation. But as you saw in terms of my installation, it was a stark contrast between your installation and my installation. Both of those installations really reflecting the culture of those two institutions. So if anybody's ever looked at my installation, you get a flavor of what it's like being at a HBCU, understanding the history and traditions of that great university. Oftentimes, we don't get a chance to see great traditions other than that. And then when I went to your installation, I was so pleased with the way in which you put that together. Share with our audience and our listeners how you thought about your installation and why it was so important that you have had all the cultural kinds of artifacts associated with it.
So yeah, we really wanted to reflect the history of our university, which you've somewhat alluded to already tonight. We can certainly talk more about it. But within that ceremony, as you recall, one of the first things that happens is that a flutist comes in with Native American music. And with the flutists are four of our Lumbee ambassadors. The Lumbee Nation is very proud of its history.
Robin, could you hold on just a moment? I think we're having some technical issues. Does anybody know where that sound is coming from? Or is it feeding into the broadcast? We're okay? The sound for the broadcast is okay? Okay. Maybe it's some feedback. Maybe it's feedback that I'm getting, but I just heard some noise. I'm sorry, because I didn't want our listeners to miss this. Go ahead, please.
So one of the first things that we had in our ceremony, it's quiet in there, and you got the pomp and circumstance, that goes with that kind of an event. But then it gets quiet, and then you hear this flute, Native American flute, that comes out of the background, piped in over our sound system. And in walks this gentleman in regalia, appropriate dress, and behind him are four what we call Lumbee ambassadors. And these are queens of the Lumbee Nation, starting from the very small at 6-7 years of age all the way up to the teenager. And therefore, one tradition that the Lumbee people have is we enjoy our beauty pageants. And so throughout the year that we will have pageants, we have something called Lumbee Homecoming here in town. And when you have 20, 30,000 people who will come in for the week, everyone plans their homecoming at that time. Unfortunately, it was canceled this year, which was a big, big loss in a number of ways. But those four beauty queens are in just incredible regalia. I mean, these outfits that the young ladies are wearing, their families have worked on, grandparents, grandmothers have worked on, just a lot of history in these outfits that they're wearing, and everyone tells a different story. And so the flute players come in, followed by those four, and it's just an absolute serene, surreal moment. And so we march in, and you have the procession, we go up to the stage, and there's just a lot of ceremony and how everything is arranged, and it goes through. We do the same thing when we have our commencement services, Elwood, and I've had several of the Board of Governors say, I've never experienced anything like that. Governor Codis, who we both know very well, he's not sort of, as we say, a touchy-feely kind of a guy, but he came and he came up to me afterwards and he said, I've never experienced anything like that. He said, when we came in, I felt like I was being transported to a different world or whatever. And he said, then when we came back out, he said that it was just very, very an impressive ceremony. So it really, there's a lot of imagery, a lot of things that go into our commencement services, but went into my installation that reflect a proud history of a tribe who had a tribe that's put a lot of emphasis on the power and the potential and the promise of education. And that's why this school was established 133 years ago, why it continues to survive as it does now, and why it's such a center point of this region, and certainly a center point and a point of great, great pride for the Lumbee people.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, it was certainly emotional for me being in that space. And I was just so proud that you honored your tradition and your history and your culture. What was it like for you, Robin, being in that space, being in that ceremony, knowing now you becoming chancellor at UNC Pembroke?
just an unimaginable day that day when I woke up, and all day long, it was like a feeling of floating and just heading toward what I knew what was going to happen that day, and immense pride. I've been blessed to do some incredible things in my life, and blessed because of education, because of the power of education. But that day was the culmination of a lot for me. I grew up around UNC Pembroke. At that time, it was Pembroke State University. And I always respected and loved the university, as do we all do here in the area. But I never dreamed I would hold this position. And it wasn't something I saw, Elwood. I went away to school, to Chapel Hill, then to Duke, to medical school. And after that, I wanted to be a heart surgeon. So I stayed at Duke for 9 more years after medical school to train to be a heart surgeon. And the first heart operation I did by myself was just a crowning achievement, and something, again, to realize what you're doing there. And I thought I would never cap that, but that day surpassed that experience. And so just walking into the Gibbons Performing Arts Center, following those four beautiful ladies and the flute player, and listening and looking around at the place that was filled, it's 1,700 seat auditorium, was overwhelming. And talk about it much more, I'll have to stop.
No, powerful. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. If we look at your life just a little bit, Robin, there are many parts of you. You've kind of done many things in your life. You were certainly a surgeon, healthcare administrator, now, president, chancellor of a university. I know how you grew up in rural North Carolina, like I grew up in rural North Carolina. Robin, how in the world does a little boy growing up in rural North Carolina end up becoming a surgeon? And talk to me a little bit about what that was like and some of the influencers in your life that motivated you to continue on that path. And I think that's so important for the students at UNC Pembroke, but all the students that we serve. How did that happen?
Short answer is, how does it happen? Is you grow up with two incredible parents. And so I was the second youngest of 9 kids, 6 boys, 3 girls. We lived on a 25-acre farm out in a community 3 miles from where we're sitting right now, called Union Chapel. And so I grew up on that farm. My dad was a Methodist minister. And back in those days, and ministers did not make very good salaries. And I often think, Elwood, how in the world that man and that lady raised 9 kids, and we all turned out relatively normal and productive individuals. And they must have gone to bed many, many times at night worried about how I'm going to feed these kids and so forth. But we made it. And I tell a story, and I've told it many times, that I grew up thinking we were pretty rich. Hmm. Because we did have a house that my parents owned. We didn't rent. It was a very small cinder block house. And so, the house was always clean. Mom was always there. She was a stay-at-home mom, and very proud of that. She did, again, a great job. Dad was always gone because he was always at the church. But, I always had a clean clothes. Might be, I can remember having two pair of pants, and that's what I had. And I would clean them, wash them during the week and put them on the next day. And for Sunday, we had special clothes that we would wear to church, or Sunday night and Wednesday night. But I just felt like, wow, we're doing well. We must be rich. Once in a while, Dad would give us a nickel to buy some ice cream or something at school. And we had food in the morning when I left, breakfast on the table.
Did you say a nickel?
a nickel. Oh, but that was a long time ago, man. That was when bubble gum was a penny. So we would go to school and come back, and but I had to spend. But now I look back on it and I realize we were pretty poor. We were pretty poor, but our parents were, my mom and my dad were always there, and so I grew up watching my dad in front of a group of people. He was the minister of Prospect Methodist Church, which became, under his leadership, the largest American Indian church east of the Mississippi.
Wow.
600 members. And I can take you to that building today and show you exactly where my mom would lead me and my younger brother and my two older sisters. And we sat, and you didn't speak. You didn't move, because you didn't, not in those days. And so
there were consequences.
There were serious consequences too. So I sat there and I watched and looked up to my dad for the first 17 years of my life, every Sunday morning, and watched him preach and lead people. And I've told you before how that I feel that marked me in a very special way and made me comfortable getting up in front of people and speaking and leading. And so I grew up on the farm. We had cucumbers. I have a story I tell folks, from cucumbers to cardiac surgeon to chancellor. And so we picked cucumbers,
three seeds.
And we had tobacco, about an acre and a half of tobacco. We had corn and cotton. And then at some point in my life, we switched over to bell peppers and cabbage and collards and those kinds of things that we would gather, because there was more money there, and we would take it to the market on the tractor. So I grew up working hard. That marked me, because, you know, I tell people, when I went to Chapel Hill, I would be sitting around with my friends and they're saying, oh gosh, this is such hard work. Look, we got to study. We got to get ready for this test. I can't believe it. And I would look at them and say, this is not hard work.
Right.
Come with me to Pembroke and I'll show you hard work. This is fun. We're sitting in an air-conditioned library, and we're studying, we're learning stuff. So hard work, I grew up appreciating what hard work was about. I grew up appreciating education.
Mm-hmm.
The school system that I went to was not a great one, but I had incredible teachers from first grade, Miss Edna Lee, all the way up through the 12th grade.
What was the teacher that you mentioned?
Miss Edna Lee.
Miss Edna Lee, and what grade was that?
That was the first grade.
That was the first grade.
Yeah, you didn't have K kindergarten at that
time.
No,
I didn't go to kindergarten either. So I'm a lot younger than you.
No. Miss Edna Lee was this lady who just loved her, and she had 30 some kids in her room, and she kept us all in order. But I just felt safe with her. You know, you're leaving first grade and you got a mom and you got 9 kids in the family. You sort of scared when you go away to school. Miss Edna Lee made me feel very comfortable, but I was blessed to have a lot of good teachers for those 12 years. And I remember in the 10th grade, my biology teacher, Mr. Steve Jones, we were dissecting a worm or a frog or something. And he comes up behind me and taps me on the shoulder. And he says, you look like you enjoy that. And I said, well, this is interesting. And he asked me some questions. And he just, as he walked away, said, you know, you ought to think about being a doctor. And Elwood, I'm telling you, I can take you exactly where it was that day. It's now a middle school. It's not a high school any longer. But that really, I just went home that day thinking, he really thinks I could be a doctor. Now, I had never thought about that. He thinks I can be a doctor. But from that day forward, that was my goal. And as I went through the 11th and 12th grade and then got into Chapel Hill, and, you know, everyone that goes to Chapel Hill, they want to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Right.
The first class I was in at Chapel Hill, there were 400 and some students in that class. I remember opening the door to this massive auditorium, and it was full. And some guy walks by me, and I say, is this a real class? I mean, I'm from Pembroke, guys. I'm first time I've been away from home. And that guy looked at me like, man, what wagon did you just fall off?
You were probably afraid to death.
I was petrified. I was petrified. But I'll tell you a story. I grew up around a university, this university in my town, and I drove by it. I can remember going to elementary school and on a bus 315, public school bus. And I remember looking over and seeing all these buildings, and I saw people who didn't look like me, and then I later interacted with people who didn't talk like me. And I would hang around in the Mary Livermore Library, and that's where Rebecca and I would sneak off to date.
Wait. This is in high school or college?
No, this was in high school. Now, I'm talking about leading up to what helped me go into that class that day.
Wait a minute, you were dating Rebecca in high school?
I was dating Rebecca in middle school.
In middle school?
She was eighth grade, I was seventh grade.
I've never heard of such a thing in my life. Y'all need to stop it. It did.
So where? Yeah.
I met Denise in the ninth grade.
Yeah.
But you know, we were friends and stuff in high school, but we didn't start dating until freshman year in college. I've never heard of anyone meeting in middle school. But on with your story.
So where we met the first time is about 200 yards in that direction. The old high school was over next to the university here. But first time I saw her, I thought, that's the prettiest girl I've ever seen. She says the first time she saw me, she said, that guy's got more freckles than anyone I've ever seen. But we started dating, and we continued to date through that. But anyway, so my point being is that when I grew up in high school and even before, I was accustomed to coming to what was called a college. So when I walked in that room that day, what made me put that foot, my next foot forward, and go and sit, find a seat and sit down, was it scared me, but I kind of felt, I know about this. This is not unusual. This is bigger than what I'm used to, but I can do this. And so people have asked me in my life, which school influenced you the most, UNC Chapel Hill or Duke? And I say it was Pembroke State University. Hmm. Pembroke State University gave me the courage to start that educational journey. So been blessed. I don't know how far you want me to go into this, but ended up.
No, I mean, I just want to give a sense of, because I think when you talk about these stories and when I listen to you talk about your students, I can see how these stories have impacted your leadership and how you try to lead UNCP to the highest possible level. You know, I have nothing but respect for you, your leadership, your place in the UNC system, and I value that. And I think when people hear this, they get a deep appreciation for Robin Cummins, the man kind of behind, you know, what you do every day. You talked about, you know, the importance of education, and you also talked about the importance of hard work. But you also now are beginning, as I hear you talk, to have a sense of confidence. Talk about how important it was for you to have confidence, and how important it is for students who attend our universities to begin to develop that sense of confidence. What you told me, and I'm gonna share just a quick story with you because it's very similar to what you talked about. I didn't go to kindergarten. I went to first grade. My first grade teacher was Miss Murphy. And Miss Murphy, you know, she followed my career up until she passed, you know, and she just wanted me to do well. I share now with my students, and sometimes they ask me, like, when did you know you were going to be successful? Or when did you know you were going to accomplish things? Well, it begins very early on. And I tell folks, I knew I was going to be successful when I went from the first grade to the second grade. The most powerful experience that I've ever had was seeing on my first grade report card that I had been promoted to the second grade. Because for me, Robin, it wasn't a given that you could just move to the next grade. So at the end of the first grade, when we got our end of year report card, I was panicking because I didn't know if I had made my grade or not. I didn't know that. And then Miss Murphy, when she came over to me, I think I must have been about to cry or something. And she came over to me and she said, look on the back of the card. And I looked on the back of the card and I can still see it now, promoted to the second grade. That was amazing. It gave me confidence. The teachers, as you talked about, giving you confidence throughout your educational career, that's so important. That's what I see you and your leadership at UNC Pembroke.
No question. Again, I give credit to a lot of people, and I often look at the journey, and I'm sure you look at your journey too, and just wonder, this door closed, that door opened. I could have never gone away to school unless I got a scholarship, and I got one at the last minute. I could have never gone to medical school unless I got a scholarship, and I got one almost at the last minute. But I think the confidence comes from being successful. You know, you get that first win in life. I remember in high school when I graduated, that to me, like you say, that was a win. I had done something. I had completed something. And then undergrad, you finish, you complete that, and then you complete your all your other studies. But for me, it's been a gradual process of confidence always. And I think, and I go back to my family. I go back to what I learned growing up, the value system that I learned, to respect other people, to treat others as you would have them to treat you, and to respect hard work. All those things sort of coming together. And as you work hard and you see successes in life, and you say, okay, I can do that. You know, I couldn't play ball. I mean, I tried out for basketball and I got cut second week, and played football, but I think that was because they didn't have enough players to make a team. So athletic, I was not an athlete. I couldn't play a guitar. I couldn't sing, but I could study and I could do well in school. And when I saw those grades on my report card every year, okay, I can do this. And I remember going, you probably remember going from one grade to the next thinking, yeah, man, can I do the eighth grade? Well, look at those guys, look how big they are. And boy, look at these books. And I just don't know if I, and then, okay, I finished the eighth grade and did okay. How about the ninth grade? And you just keep building that confidence. It's important that students believe in yourself. Believe that you can do it. Yeah. I tell my students, you know, work hard and take full advantage of the talent that you've been given in life. But hard work is a prerequisite. If you're not willing to work hard, unless you're gifted some other way, you're probably not going to achieve in life what you could. So don't be afraid of hard work. I tell the story that when I was in college, this kid from Pembroke, first time out of away from home and scared to death, and I took that first test, just like you're talking about, that first Chem 11 test, and I actually made a B plus on it. And I said, whoa, 400 students and I made a B plus. I can do this. And so as I went through undergrad, I just had those little goals for myself. And I was always pleasantly surprised. If I work hard, if I stay in the library long enough and don't get distracted, I can do well. Yeah. But it's important that students have a goal in life, a focus in life. And I say, once you achieve that goal, then set another one and keep moving toward it. Always have something I'm trying to do, I'm trying to accomplish. Work hard. And I tell them to use time wisely. Someone told me once, you got 1,440 minutes every day. And when that one's gone, it's gone. You can't get it back. So when you wake up in the morning, someone has deposited 1,440 minutes into your bank account. What are you going to do with them? You can waste them that day, or you can say, today I will do this and I will accomplish. Don't waste time. I remember so well, my mother, again, 3 miles from here, sitting, I would always come over and sit with her on Sunday afternoons. At that time, I was in Pinehurst as a surgeon. And I remember one Sunday that we were sitting there and she said, son, one day you will look back and 85 years have passed and you're going to wonder where they went. Hmm. And I'll never forget the look on her face, because she dreaded getting old. She said, it's not the golden years, these are the rusty years. And she said, take advantage. And she knew what I had accomplished and done in life. She said, continue to take advantage of the doors, of the opportunity that God's going to put in your life.
Great story, man. Keep telling those stories, man. Those are great Let's talk a little bit about where you are now, what you do. You, University of North Carolina at Pembroke, we are in a large system, 17 constituent parts of that big system. And oftentimes for me at Winston-Salem State University, I talk about it's easy for smaller universities to sometimes get lost in a system because we have so many flagship universities. I think we have several flagship universities, not just one. But it means that for me, we have to constantly tell our story. So I'm constantly telling the Winston-Salem State University story. I shared with my executive team just the other day that this is my sixth year as chancellor. I'm in my sixth year, having completed six, so 5.5 years. And in 5.5 years, I'm about to get my fourth president of the system, which means that now I have to once again start telling the story about Winston-Salem State University. This is an opportunity for you right now. Tell us the UNC Pembroke story.
The history or where
we are? Not necessarily the history of it. I mean, you don't have to go through all of that, but tell us like who are you and how do you navigate and how do you think about being in a system and what are some of the issues that you struggle with, being in a system of higher ed?
Well, you've alluded to the fact that we are in a system and you and I have relatively small schools. And honestly, we've never had a voice at the table. And I don't mean this in a negative way, but we've sort of had to push our way to the table and say, here we are. So you're right. We've got to meet the new president who's coming. And as you say, tell the story of UNC Pembroke, get him down here to my campus and show him around and make him put a face to the university. There are a lot of challenges with our system right now, and a lot going on that I'm sure we may touch on in terms of COVID and so forth. But it's hard work to represent a small school. But you know, you have to take the attitude that I deserve to be here. UNC Pembroke deserves to be at this table, and I'm not going to back down on that. And so I have no problem going to a legislator or going to anyone and telling the UNC Pembroke story and asking them to share with me in this story and as we move this university along. Robeson County is the poorest county in North Carolina. It's been the poorest county when 60 plus years ago when I grew up, it was the poorest county in North Carolina. So I tell legislators, if you want to do something to change the trajectory of this county, the poor health statistics, the generational poverty, all the things that impact this county, if you want to do something that maybe 10 years from now, you've changed it, UNC Pembroke is the engine, it's the tool to do that. And I tell that story and people respond to it. They can identify that education is an incredible tool. You know, it's the great equalizer. You've heard, you know, we both use all those phrases. I tell students, you know, education will put you at the table and it'll make you equal to those people sitting around the table, especially if you get enough of it. So get as much as you can. So I enjoy interacting with the folks in Raleigh, the folks in Chapel Hill, and telling the story.
Right. And you do a great job of that. Why is UNC Pembroke critical to that region?
Wow. So, you know, if you look at Robeson County, and this is my home county, and I'm not beating up on it. I love it. And I grew up here and I came back. It's got so many great, great things about it. You've got UNC system school here, UNC Pembroke. You've got Robeson Community College, 10 miles down the road. You've got Southeastern Health Hospital, 450-bed hospital here in this county. You've got Interstate 95, you've got Interstate 75. You've got so many things that many counties would just say, we would be so fortunate if we had just one or two of those things. but we haven't taken advantage of it. In my estimation, the reason we haven't taken advantage of those natural gifts is because of education. Only 13% of the people in this region have a college education. Now, this university's been here 133 years. I think that's not a good record. And I was surprised the first time I heard that statistic. So I believe that through education, we can change. I was a doctor at one point. I was Medicaid director. You had Mandy Cohen on your show just, a couple of weeks ago. And I worked in Department of Health and Human Services for a while. And I saw that big picture of all the money that we spend on healthcare, and a lot of it goes into Robeson County. And I told people then, if we want to change people's health, you can't afford to treat someone who they're not invested in their own health. Yep. It will cost you. I mean, it will break our system. So I talked about the importance of education. You educate a person who's with a college education, you know the statistics. Yep. They make more money, they live a healthier life, they take care of themselves, their families are better, and so forth. So that was one of the things, Elwood, when I got that call and someone said, are you interested in coming to look at UNC Pembroke to be chancellor? And I had worked all my life in the field of medicine. And I thought, well, I've said all along that education is better than pills, and it's better than just if people get involved, get educated, get involved with their own healthcare, you can really make a difference. So that was one of the reasons. So that's why I think this university is critical to change southeastern North Carolina, as well as Robeson County.
Right, and you go down with your background in terms of healthcare, and one of the first things you do is start building a School of Health Sciences. Take us through that. I mean, that's an amazing kind of accomplishment in a short period of time. It's certainly part of your legacy as Chancellor at UNC Pembroke. You've been staffing that thing. You stole one of my people the other day, but you so graciously called me and we had a nice conversation about it.
And you were so gracious. we established a College of Health Sciences 3 years ago, and it's about 1,700 students. We're going to do some adjusting with it, but we started it by combining our counseling school, our athletic program, our social work program, and our nursing school. And like you, our nursing program is not quite as developed and mature as your university school of nursing, but we're working on it. But it has become a star for us. Our pass rate is in the 95% plus range. This year, Elwood, I'm proud to say that, and this is sort of bad to say this, but we turned away students this year that in the past it would have been a no-brainer that they come on in. It just shows, number one, the demand for nursing. Students want that degree, and so you're seeing the demand increase. But our nursing program is growing. But we pulled those four departments together and formed our College of Health Sciences. Our next goal is to develop a Doctor of Occupational Therapy program. We want to bring a DNP, Doctor of Nursing Practice, to the school. I think it's possible in the years to come that UNC Pembroke could have a PA school here on campus. In this region, that demand is so high. And what's great about our students here, and same thing I'm sure with your students, is they tend to stay here. I mean, students come here, right, and many are from this region. 85% of our nurses stay in this region to practice.
So that's powerful. That's a powerful statement.
Right? And if we can develop OT programs and physical therapy programs and PA programs, those people will stay. Robeson County, in the surrounding counties, if you look at Robert Wood Johnson Foundation program, each year they rank every county in the United States according to its health statistics. Yeah. And this region, Southeast North Carolina, has counties that are in the 90% to 100 out of 100 counties in North Carolina. So again, think of all those folks who are coming to Pembroke. They graduate and 80% plus stay in the region.
Right.
The economic impact of it. So we're excited about our College of Health Sciences. The COVID and the budget crisis has sort of slowed us down a little bit, but we're going to get there one day.
Yeah, that's a great testament and tribute to your leadership in that region. A lot of people know, Robert, how diverse UNC Pembroke is. Tell us about your student body.
So very proud. We're this past year our highest enrollment of 7,700 students. 1,300 of those are in our graduate programs. But if you look at our student body, we're looked at by U.S. News World Report as one of the most diverse campuses in the South. That our statistics last year, 31% African-American, 38% white, 14% American Indian, 8% Hispanic, and then just a lot of other ethnicities and folks here on campus. And so this is a special time for us as we go through America as it's sort of trying to again find its identity in this whole area of race relations and so forth. And we put a lot of effort into trying to make everyone on our campus feel included and you know, a sense of inclusiveness. And we're not anywhere near where we need to be, but we're trying and we're making steps in that direction. But we are very proud of our diversity. It's something that we hold up as one of the strong points. If you walk across my campus, you're going to see folks who I think look like the America of 10 years from now, that just different ethnicities, different races.
Yeah, I made a very powerful statement in terms of looking at your campus, talking about diversity and inclusion. Also talk to me a little bit about you being chancellor at that university. What challenges does that present? I know we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I do want to get into the whole issue where I think are two powerful issues that are affecting higher ed today. And that is what's happening in this country. One is around the pandemic. We'll get a chance to, we'll close on that one. The other around race relations in this country, probably people in this area as well as in your area know a little bit about what happened at UNC Pembroke over the weekend with the march. Could you talk a little bit about that? Who calls someone at 9 o'clock at night?
And they should know that you're taping a show. I mean, you got your show going. God, people are so irresponsible, inconsiderate.
I know.
We had a group of students. We're in our summer program, so we don't have a lot of students around, but we did have a group of students who approached the town of Pembroke that they wanted to have a Black Lives Matter march through town. And so the town worked with them. We were not asked to participate, for whatever reason. The university was not asked by the students to sanction the event. It was not an SGA event. But we were involved with it from time zero. We worked with the town to for some of the logistics. The students wanted to have the march at 5 p.m. on Friday afternoon, which is the highest traffic count of the week for the town. I mean, literally two lanes of traffic in each direction in a small town at 5 o'clock with thousands of cars who are passing through. You would think it's a small city. And the town at first pushed back a little bit because they were concerned about safety. Students agreed that they would stay on, walk on the sidewalk. And so we had our march at 5 o'clock. I marched with the student. I'm proud to say that we had probably a dozen, two dozen of our administrators who were with the school, with the students, with the march. We were anticipating at first maybe 30 people. We ended up with 125, 150 plus people who participated in the march. And the march went through downtown Pembroke and turned around and then came back to campus, started on campus and ended up back on campus. Pembroke is the home of the Lumbee Indian tribe. And so as it was an interesting to see some of the dynamics that went on. And the marchers were very peaceful and very appropriate, but some of the tribal folks, I think, took somewhat of an offense, And so long story short, it turned out to be everyone was safe. No one was hurt. There were, you know, but there was, the police did a wonderful job. I want to say our town police, the university police, the county police worked together to keep the two groups separate. But it was an event that was marred a bit by some ugly protest that I found very abhorrent and really a bit embarrassing. Right. And so anyway, we came back to campus and the students ended with some very nice speeches about race relations and what we do next. And so I'm proud to say in the last 2 days, over the weekend and in the last 2 days, I've met with the student, with the leaders of our various student groups together as well as apart. I've met with the town council last night. The town council is now asking, has given me permission or asked me to talk with the students and see if the students, the organizers would like to meet with them to have a discussion. I plan to meet with faculty and so forth. So a lot of meetings, but you know, Elwood, you and I are old enough. And as an American Indian, I've heard the conversations before about race relations. And you go through these periods where sort of things bubble up to the top and then they just go away and you look back and say, well, what really happened? So my challenge to the students, my challenge to my faculty, my challenge to the town council is, what are we going to do? What are we going to do at this time that we can look back and say, okay, that was a change. That was one step. Now what's the next step? I met with my, as part of my meetings, I met with the president of my alumni association, who is African American. And he said, well, Chancellor, what do we want at this time? Do we want a moment or do we want momentum? And I said, I choose the latter. And so we had a healthy discussion. The president of our student government association is Katrea Hardison, who's African-American female. And we've had some good conversations between all of us in the last few days, but I'm pushing them to what do we do? I've met with my police department. You know, part of the march was against police brutality. And so we have a good department here, and but they can be better. And so I've challenged my police department. I want you to come back and I want you to tell me specific things that we are going to do in the months ahead around cultural sensitivity and so forth. Not that we've had a specific issue. We have probably, like most campuses, had issues that we've had to deal with, but it's not like it's a glaring problem, but I want to make it better. I don't want to wait. So we lots of conversations. Yeah. And I really believe, Elwood, that at least on our campus, and I'm hoping for the town, that we work well with the town, our relationships with the mayor and the town council. I meet with them on a quarterly basis. We're working about what we can do for the students and so forth and for the university. And they really want to, the university and the town to work well together. But growing pains yeah. that we need to deal with.
You know, one of the things, and I think about you, and I thought about you over the weekend, and you know, oftentimes I reach out to you and just to see how you're doing. I am actually thankful, I think, for the region and for the area that you're there. And I think under your leadership and because of your leadership, this is a moment in time for us to make a real difference. Oftentimes, when the various constituencies look at us and look at you, sometimes they just see a chancellor, sometimes sitting up on a pedestal. You shared with us, we're almost out of time, but you shared with me why race relations is so important to you and why you will always fight racism. Tell us a story about you and your father.
So I remember a few years back, many years back, my dad was a minister. I've never seen him politically involved. It was just not something. He was into the church and it was about his ministry. But at one point here in our county, there was an incident where the son of the local sheriff, who was white, shot an Indian man and killed him. And the feeling and the word in the community was it was the guy was working with the son, who was a deputy sheriff, to sell drugs. And again, I hope I'm not I think this was a very commonly held story, but nothing was done about that man's murder. And so the people marched, the Indian people marched, got together. And I remember seeing my dad for the only time and the first time in his life with this white shirt on and his black tie on and with his hat on, with a sign around his neck out here saying equal justice for all, equal justice for all. And this was probably back in the mid-1980s or so. And so we marched from one part of Robeson County to the courthouse, and we held a vigil there. And it was very moving. But that's what we share with our African-American brothers and sisters, that the Lumbee folks have experienced that same level of racism in the past. And this is a chance, this is a time if we can do away with some of the mistrust. And I want to say that the people that were shouting and screaming at the protesters was a minority of people. There are 60,000 Lumbees. There might have been 200 people spread along a 1 mile stretch of highway, if maybe 300. I forget what the exact, but it wasn't like it was thousands. And I tell my students, that was a small group of people. Ignore them. You're loved by the people in this county. You're loved by the people in this community. And we have a chance to make a bold statement about two distinct races who have traveled different paths converging and coming together if we're smart and we ask the right questions and have the right conversations. I'm meeting with this group of community leaders tomorrow, and I'm hoping that we can have some kind of solidarity in how we move forward.
Yeah. You know, Robin, as I listened to you talk, and I was just reflecting on once again why I'm glad that you're chancellor at UNCP. And it's about these institutions, and we are in a large system, and sometimes the culture, the history, the tradition of these institutions can get lost. And I think about how important it is to have a leader who understands that and who can reflect that and who can have these conversations. I sometimes shudder to think about if there was a different leader at UNCP, what would be happening? You're there at this time for the right reason. And you know that I'm going to support you. I believe in the work that you're doing, man.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you. I love you so much, man.
Man, I got to thank you for being on the show. See, you, I knew you were going to talk too much and we're out of time, and I didn't get a chance to get to half of the things I wanted to talk about. And so now I got to have you to come back on the show.
I'll be glad to come back anytime.
I got to have, take us out, man, with where you are, what you're thinking, what you're optimistic about. I know you began this discussion talking about the challenges that we face, and there are many. Take us out. Tell me what excites you in the midst of all of this.
That things are going to get better. I just know that. I mean, again, we've had a few decades in our life, and this is a time, and it's a trying time. I mean, between COVID and all these things that we're facing, this too shall pass. And what we need to do is be prepared when it does pass. I'm optimistic about our university, our College of Health Sciences. Before, we're going to be looking at how we can develop agricultural programs here, because this is a rich agricultural area. We've added cybersecurity to our computer science program. School of Nursing, or Department of Nursing, has really taken off. So I'm optimistic that when we get through all this, when we get that vaccine that Dr. Fauci talked about, January, February, I'm going to call him and hold him to that and say, okay, it's January 31st. Where's my vaccine? When we get that vaccine, we can move on from COVID, and when the budget corrects itself, and even before. And there's positive things happening right now. So I'm looking for better days, and I know they're coming.
They are indeed. I look forward to continuing the conversation. Look forward to seeing you on another Zoom meeting, probably Thursday. I think it's Thursday. I think the next Zoom meeting is Thursday. Yes, take sir. Good care, my friend. Thanks for hanging out with me, for giving me an hour of your time. I hope that you got a chance to kind of get away from all the things that you're doing and just kind of relax a little bit and have a great conversation on Future Focus Now. That's what we do every week. Spread the word. Tell folks about Future Focus. I think this is going to be a great conversation. I think people, your administration, I think students, I think people in the area are really going to want to hear. We create a podcast. The podcast should be available in a couple of days, and we'll have this up on YouTube as well, where everybody can see it that did not get a chance to see it live. Thank you so much. Tell Rebecca I said hello. I know she's tired of you since middle school, but tell her I said hello, and we'll be in touch real soon. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll be back next week for another edition of Future Focus Now.